What is healthy eating and how affordable is it? Well, in this episode of the Obelisk podcast, we will be exploring barriers to healthy eating and how we can encourage children to eat more healthily. I'm your host, Kate Wall. I'm a registered nutritionist and I've been working in weight management for the past 5 years. With me is Anita Mirandi, an associate professor, medical doctor, paediatrician and PhD with particular interest in genetics, diabetology, endocrinology and clinical nutrition. Anita is also a member of the European Childhood Obesity Group and is working as a partner in the Obelisk project. Hi, Anita, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Kate. It's really nice to be addressing the important topic of a healthy diet, because we all know that a healthy diet establishes during childhood and tend to become ingrained during adulthood, where it is very difficult to change if it is not correct.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think it's best if we just dive straight into the topic of healthy eating. We all know it's important, but it can be really confusing to know what healthy eating actually means. And I know people that I've worked with feel like one day they're told to eat more of something, the next day they hear the opposite. And the media is always throwing around different messages about nutrition. It can be really hard to know what's true, and I think that can lead to people either misunderstanding how to eat healthily or just giving up on trying because it all just feels too hard to achieve. So I wonder, what do you think on this, Anita? And are there some clear key messages that we could help people to cut through the noise and really understand what it means to eat healthily?
Well, Kate, I totally agree with you about the frequent confusion and the misleading messages around healthy eating and healthy foods. But according to a huge amount of scientific evidence, we can provide people with important key messages. The first one, especially speaking about children and adolescents, is that the healthy diet must provide them with all the nutrients needed for proper physical growth and neurocognitive development. This is the reason why most countries all over the world provide recommended dietary intakes, which are tailored to cover the needs of the 95% of children and adolescents to avoid deficiencies. And this is a very important tool, a very important reference while setting the portions for communities, for schools, for example, for boarding schools and so on. But it could be even a little risky and misleading while determining the correct portions for the single child, because we have to keep in mind that we are speaking about avoiding deficiencies and covering the 95% of individuals during the growth period. So most of children and adolescents will require portions and amounts which are largely lower than those recommended by the recommended dietary intakes rules. And so the first important key message is for all caregivers and parents in particular is that even if their children do not void the plate completely and do not eat completely the typical portions offered, provided that they grow well, it is not a problem. It means that it is the right portions for them. And so we have not to focus on a fixed concept of amounts for children, but be sure that children grow correctly with their own needs, their own amounts. Only very few children, for example, with a tall stature or very vigorous physical activity or special medical needs will require amounts which are greater than or equal to the recommended dietary intakes for the population. The other important concept is that we have not to focus on the single food items, demonizing completely some foods and promoting completing some others, but rather it is more important to speak about healthy dietary patterns, because when we focus too much on the single foods, we risk to fall into an overly rigid attitude, or even we risk to surrender in face of rules which are too difficult to follow. And so it is very important to consider the diet as a whole. But beyond the quantitative balance and flexibility, of course, we have to provide some key messages about the concrete content of this healthy diet. Many recommendations have been provided over time, but most of them share the fundamental characteristics, which are based, of course, on nutritional evidence and on important epidemiological connections between these characteristics and the health outcomes. And these characteristics are, of course, the richness in fruit and vegetables, about the 50% of energy coming from starches, in particular whole grains, very moderate amounts of red meat, and moderate amounts of animal proteins, small amounts of fat, in particular saturated fats, and the avoidance, of course, of fast foods, soft drinks, and the so-called hedonic foods, such as, for example, sweetened and salty snacks, which are very palatable, of course, especially for children and adolescents, but are all very low quality. And a very consolidated example of such diets is the Mediterranean diet, which of course encourages a great variety and quantity of fruit and vegetables, but also the important use of grains, whole grains in particular, legumes, moderate quantities of poultry, eggs, fish, and dairy, the use of nuts, and low amounts of red meat, but also highlights the importance of avoiding cooking with fats, in particular frying, and of course avoiding fast foods and ultra-processed foods. We are speaking of a very culturally adaptable dietary model, which can be easily evaluated in children with a very simple questionnaire, which is called the KidMed second version, which is composed of 16 very easy yes-no questions about the nutritional habits, and which is a score to evaluate the degree of Mediterraneanness of a child diet. Other models exist, for example, the Flemish diet quality score, which shares much important features with the Mediterranean diet, and also dietary models which combine the concept of a healthy diet for the individual with an affordable diet for the planet are more and more widespread. The most scientifically robust of these models is the Lancet Planetary Health Diet built by the non-profit EAT Commission, which is very similar to the Mediterranean model, but it highlights even a greater shift from the animal-based to the plant-based proteins, of course, in view of the planet protection, of course.
Yeah, loads of interesting points there. And a great way to think about it as being an overall diet and how we can make that culturally appropriate. But I guess one might wonder, to what extent in the Europe does the European consumer know how to eat healthily, and how the European regulations help them in doing that? And I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, since 2016, based on the European law called Food Information to Consumers, approved in 2011, all the packages of foods must include a back label containing all the information about calories, the nutrient content of the food per 100 grams and per portion, so fat, sugars, and so on. And since 2017, Europe have been also encouraging voluntary adoption of a front package nutritional claims, which are meant to be nutritional summaries, increasing the consumer awareness about the healthiness of the food. So, for example, some of these nutritional claims, which must be justified by specific requirements which have been regulated by Europe, are energy restricting, or for example, no added sugar, on the low fat, and so on. And recently, there is also a growing debate across Europe about the advisability to impose the mandatory use of front score of healthiness for every food, for example, in the form of light traffics or alphabetic or chromatic scores, for example, from green to red or from A to F, to give the consumers an idea about the healthiness of the single food. An example of this is the Nutri-Score adopted by France, based on the salt, sugar, and fat content of each food. This type of labeling, of course, can have the advantage to raise the awareness of consumers, but it still needs a long-term research about the hard health outcomes associated with it in terms of cardiovascular disease, obesity, cancers, and so on, and not only in terms of spending habits or choices of the consumers, of course. And we also keep in mind that, especially while speaking about preventing or treating obesity, some of these messages, some of these labels could even become a little misleading if they are not supported by a sufficient knowledge behind about what nutrients are and about the overall caloric balance and about the personal needs of the consumer. And so, for example, according to my experience, I can tell you that I saw several parents of children or adolescents with obesity allowing unrestricted amounts of natural juices because of the label no added sugar, while banning completely even small amounts of zero calories drinks because of the content of sweeteners. And this could not be completely correct in the case of obesity, for example. And this is the case of many other foods, for example, the low energy or low fat foods, which are always allowed without any restriction, because the awareness is not complete regarding the overall energy balance, which is the main topic while speaking about obesity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've certainly seen that in the UK too, within my practice. Nutrition labelling's been introduced, but the education is not always behind it. And I do think that can lead to confusion at a consumer level. I've certainly seen people avoiding things like nuts, for example, because they're red on the labels. So there is, I think, lots of potential for this as an intervention, but it's just being mindful of effective implementation strategies if we want to make sure that we see meaningful change from it, I guess. So, in summary to that question, a healthy diet is about much more than just calories. We need a wide range of nutrient-dense foods to get all the vitamins and minerals that are essential for good health. And being able to eat a healthy, nutritious diet is one of our most basic human needs. Yet, unfortunately, there are many people going without, and they are suffering from hidden hunger, micronutrient deficiencies, whether that be too little iron, calcium, vitamin A. And I don't think it's always understood that people can be living with obesity and be malnourished, you know, that sort of double burden of malnutrition. So we just need to consider dietary patterns as much more than just the balance of calories that meet that individual's needs when we're discussing this area. So we know that healthy eating is important for children, and we've outlined what that means in terms of plenty of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, etc. But I guess the big question is healthy eating actually affordable? Are families able to keep their children's plates full of nutritious foods without breaking the bank? The cost of a healthy diet has been on the rise in recent years. The surge in the cost of a healthy diet reflects that overall rise in food inflation that's hit every region following various things, including the pandemic, the energy crisis, climate change. The Health Behaviour in School Aged Children study highlighted the rise in unhealthy eating habits, rising rates of overweight and obesity, and low levels of physical activity among young people, with those from less affluent families disproportionately affected. So, for example, adolescents from less affluent families are more likely to be overweight and obese, 27% compared to 18% of their wealthier peers. So there are certainly many people across Europe who feel that it is more expensive to eat a healthy diet. So is this the case? Is healthy eating just unaffordable?
Well, the question whether healthy eating is currently affordable for families across Europe is not very easy to answer. Probably the short answer is that currently many families encounter difficulties facing the nutritional choices for their children, and access to a healthy diet is very difficult for many families. The first question is economic, because even if the statistics concerning the food prices increase only tell us that the European region has been less affected than other regions all over the world, the general life cost has increased in Europe, especially the energy cost, and this drives many families to prefer ultra-processed industrial and foods which are characterized by a low energy intake price ratio, and are not perishable, and are very, very quick to cook, and so they require a low amount of energy to consume, to cook, and so on. And some of these disadvantaged families also rely on food banks for their nutrition, for the nutrition of their children. And we know that food banks not always provide healthy foods, because they, of course, prefer non-perishable foods. But the topic is not only an economic topic, and it is much more complex than an economic question, because if we analyze the body of evidence about the reasons underpinning the well-known association between the socioeconomic status of families and their degree of diet healthiness, we see that the reasons go much beyond the economical ones. For example, according to one of the most important of these types of studies, relaying of the data about the adolescents enrolled in the ELENA studies, one of the most important explications of the association between a low socioeconomic status of the family and the low dietary quality in adolescence is the high availability of soft drinks at home, which explains almost 50% of the association of the socioeconomic status, especially parental education and the degree of the quality of diet in adolescence. Other typical characteristics of the disadvantaged families, which have been discovered to be important mediators of an unhealthy diet, are, for example, the lack of rules set by parents about diets, also the lack of availability of fruits and vegetables, and also according to the answers provided by the adolescents enrolled in this study, which provided questionnaires. Also a sort of lack of social and family support in terms, for example, of adult models, adult positive models, examples of healthy eating, and also a lack of support from peers of the same environment for a sort of food and diet trends the adolescents tend to follow, of course. And so it is much more than economics. And other reasons could be also traditions, cultures typical of each country, and even climate reasons. Of course, for climate reasons, there are countries which are less inclined than others to use legumes, to use vegetables, to have them available to cook, and so on. And for example, even in Italy, my country, which is well known to have a good food production, I can assure you that there are regions which have much less palatable fruits than others, and of course with higher prices. And so probably much of the barriers and the social inequalities experienced by disadvantaged families facing the question of nutrition could be mitigated by government policies encouraging a good education about the knowledge and the use of local seasonal products, about also cooking skills, because one of the mediators highlighted between the socioeconomic status and an healthy diet is typically a lack of cooking skills in the parents. And it would be also important that government would provide parents and families with tangible helps, tangible supports in terms, for example, of moderate price of free provisions of fruits, vegetables, and legumes, or also the organization of virtuous programs at school, such as, for example, breakfast clubs of the provisions of vegetable snacks, fruit snacks, or light snacks in any case. Another interesting strategy could be also the adoption of digital health programs, such as, for example, web or mobile apps which contain funny cooking tips, nutritional tips, and also funny challenges on nutrition and physical activity for both parents and children, to encourage, to improve the everyday introduction of good habits in real life. One example of these strategies is an app which has been implemented by the Italian Institute for Migration and Poverty a few years ago, and which is called Smuovi la Salute, which means literally move the health, and which contains many funny tips and funny challenges for parents and children, and has been proven to be effective in improving knowledge and awareness about health nutrition in migrant and poor families, and also in improving healthy choices.
Yeah, so much in there to think about, and totally agree. You know, in the UK, the same, the cost of living crisis has definitely impacted, obviously, the cost of food, and people want to make sure that they are feeding their children and that they avoid waste, and you know, often that's not the fresh foods. And it is definitely about that support. And I love that idea of an app that helps them to see how they can do that within a budget. Because certainly culturally here, like you mentioned, it's not so common for children to be used to eating foods like lentils or beans, which could be much cheaper sources of nutrition. And so the processed foods become more their comfort zone. And that's what the parents are kind of know how to go about preparing. So and the same with the food banks as well, and kind of the choice then being taken away from them in terms of what they might have available. So how can we support them to be able to use those ingredients and know which ones to pick that mean that they can get the most out of their budget and the most nutrition for the money that they've got. So yeah, loads of really important points. And I guess it's just an extremely complex issue with so many factors that influence that individual's ability to access and afford a healthy diet. This year, the World Health Organization did actually publish a guideline on the fiscal policies to support healthy diets, including both taxation and subsidies as a viable policy option to promote healthy diets, which is important as it will support creating a food environment that enables healthy dietary decisions. We have across the world seen measures such as sugar taxes being implemented in countries. And I think that can be useful in changing behaviours, but it's getting the balance of not putting all the financial burden onto those that are already struggling by taxing those less healthy foods, whilst healthier foods may not be that affordable. So, you know, therefore, I think the role of the government assisted programmes, like you mentioned, you know, subsidising healthy foods such as fruits and vegetables, free school meals, breakfast clubs, all of that playing a part in making healthy food much more affordable for more people. Mm-hmm. So let's move on and talk about children and healthy eating, because this is a topic that so many parents and caregivers grapple with. We all want to make sure our kids are eating well, but you know, it's not always that easy to get them to choose the fruits and the vegetables over snacks and sweets. It's not an easy task for parents. So it'd be really interesting if you've got some effective strategies for encouraging children to eat healthier foods. Are there ways that we can make nutritious foods more appealing and enjoyable for them?
Oh yes, the way to get one's children to eat more healthily is one of the most frequent questions of parents for the pediatricians, and there can be specific challenges to getting children to eat healthily. Some common examples are picky eating, which is very frequent, more frequent than we can think. And of course, the role of screen time and advertising, which can have a strong impact on children's food preferences and in promoting unhealthy eating habits, which become sometimes real trends among children and especially adolescents. And also, of course, cultural and family influences, family habits and cultural backgrounds could be unhealthy and, of course, could be unfavorable for the child to develop healthy attitudes, healthy habits. One of the most advisable strategies to improve the healthiness of their child's diet is to prepare good dishes, good healthy dishes. It is perhaps trivial, but we sometimes do not keep in mind enough that vegetables are not drugs are not medical treatments to give to our children to get them better, but they must be enjoyable dishes as other ones, as snacks and so on. So we must become good in preparing them, even without much fat, because it is possible. There are many seasoning techniques which allow good preparation of vegetable foods without increasing the amount of fat. And so it is important that the vegetable foods are good, fresh. And the healthy foods must also be always available for the children. So, for example, to have a bowl of fruits on the table, reachable by the children, is a very simple strategy to nudge children, to passively prompt the children to considering eating eating fruits as snacks instead of other type of snacks. Of course, we should also adopt a sort of environmental protection. I mean that, of course, if we have a strong availability, a large availability of unhealthy foods, unhealthy drinks and snacks at home, as we have just said, speaking about the evidence in European adolescents, of course, it is very hard that our children will choose vegetables, legumes, instead of salty snacks and very ultra-processed foods. Other important strategies are that we are the first model of our children, and we appear to enjoy healthy foods. Our children must see their parents to enjoy the food every day, not because it is healthy, but because it is good. So the fastest way to obtain a more healthier diet in children is to be the first one people to adopt a healthy diet. And it is also important not to be too worried when children do not accept, when children refuse new healthy foods we propose, because often it takes even 15, 20 times before the children accept a novel healthy food. And we mustn't be angry and we mustn't force children to eat the novel foods if they do not accept the first times, but we have just to praise them because they have tried. This is very, very important. Another way, of course, is to make foods enjoyable, as you said, in terms of color, in terms of look. This is very important too. And healthy food has also to be perceived as something normal, something which is part of the everyday nutrition, everyday diet, and not something to endure, to have a snack, to have a price in terms of ice cream or of another snack. So it is not something to eat because it is healthy, but afterwards we can eat something else. So it is important not to reward and not to punish with healthy foods. Healthy foods is something of our everyday nutrition for both parents and children. It is very important too, because it is really an opportunity to enjoy healthy food together, and it is a strategy to nudge children to follow our example.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, yeah, really what you're saying there is just normalizing healthy foods. So there's no good foods, bad foods, food is food, but helping to teach the children which foods we can eat more of, which foods we need every day, and how they help support that child do the things they want to do, whether that's, you know, helping to make your bones strong so you can jump higher or whatever, rather than it being something that we use as a weapon to punish, or as something to kind of dangle a carrot for a reward of some sweets. Yeah, I love all those ideas. And lots of practical tips there for parents to take away. So thank you. So you are currently working on the Obelisk Project, which is a 5-year research project with an ambition to prevent childhood obesity and contribute to enhancing the health, quality of life and lifespan of people of all ages living in Europe. So if you wouldn't mind giving us just a little bit more detail on that and how the Obelisk Project is addressing healthy eating and food affordability to prevent and treat childhood obesity.
Yes, Obelisk is a major research project encompassing an important translational component about the molecular basis of obesity, so novel physiopathological pathways towards obesity for novel potential treatments, but also an important clinical part, which is supposed to provide the Europe with novel models of prevention and treatments, and also a post-clinical exploitation and dissemination component. One of the most important feature of the clinical part is the trial TAPE obesity, which stands for Targeted Prevention of Early Obesity, which is a trial focusing targeted prevention in that intensity of interventions according to the personal risk of a newborn to develop obesity based on the family characteristics, such as, for example, the BMI of the parents, the socioeconomic status of the parents, but also based on personal characteristics, such as, for example, the birth weight. So in the intervention arm of the trial, all the families of the participating parents will benefit from the personal access to a website dedicated to the TAPE obesity, featuring a nutritional blog with cooking and nutritional tips for infants and for young children, but also an important auto-monitoring tool for the one child growth with also alert systems, and also a live chat with a pediatric dietitian in case a parent feels to need suggestion, to need advice. But about the 30% of newborns who are deemed to be at particular risk to develop obesity based on the above mentioned characteristics will also be provided with an intensive follow-up at an Obelisk center nearby the pediatric hospital in one of the recruiting towns across Europe, which are Lille, Verona, and Messina, respectively in France, Northern Italy, and Southern Italy. And during this follow-up, the families will benefit from a quarterly or even a bi-monthly monitoring from the dietitian based on the growth pattern of the child, and will benefit from cultural tailored suggestions, advice about nutrition, about growth, but also about correct physical activity habits since infancy, because even infancy is a period where we can suggest particular physical activities. This website and also the nutritional interventions will be multi-language because will be assisted by cultural mediation if needed, and also by the social assistance if needed. And so they are particularly culture and social condition tailored. And so this should improve the awareness of parents about the very early nutrition of their child, and should improve the growth trajectories of children that are particularly at risk to develop obesity. The study has just started in Verona a few weeks ago, and it has been well received by parents, most of whom accept to participate, and most of them declare that they are delighted to receive very early assistance about the nutrition of their children. So we are all very hopefully about this kind of study. The second important intervention is the adobesy trial, which regards adolescents who have obesity and who come from low-income families or families characterized by a low-level education in the parents. And so adolescents that are considered particularly at risk not to have a proper follow-up, a proper depistage of the obesity complications, both in terms of physical and in terms of psychological and social complications. And this intervention is particular because not only it will provide the participants with the standard traditional lifestyle program at the obesity center with the dietitian and with the doctor, of course, with the bi-monthly visits, but also for an important group of adolescents, an highly impactful program from the psychological and social point of view, which is constituted of a hip-hop program, which will cover the 9 months of the school year, 2025-2026, and will be remote for the first 7 months, even group session, but provided remotely for the first 7 months of the program. And it will be in presence during the last 2 months of the school year, because in this period, the group will develop an anti-stigma and an anti-bullying video, which will be an important deliverable for the Europe, because it will contain multilingual messages against the body shaming, the bullying, and the stigma. And so we hope that this experience can be highly valorizing, highly committing and engaging for our adolescents, so that we can move the focus from the medical centered point of view to a much broader point of view, which is mostly outside the clinics, outside the medical environment, and which has to do especially with emotions and also with self-esteem, with the group building and so on. And we hope that such a strategy could improve also the acceptability of the chronic intervention of to treat obesity, because don't forget that obesity is a chronic relapsing disease. So it is important to favor a good acceptance of the treatment, because even if the treatment is not so effective in decreasing the BMI, but is well accepted by adolescents, and so the dropout from the treatment is very low, it will mean that we can intercept most of the complications, and we can we will be able to help our adolescents and our future adults much more than with treatments which are not accepted and so are very frequently abandoned. And another important component of this trial is that part of the families will receive weekly packages of healthy foods from the programs for the whole duration of the programs. And this is meant to be a test of whether a tangible help in terms of provision of free vegetables and free other healthy foods can really change the habits and the quality of lives and the quality of diets of these families. Alongside the analysis of the effectiveness of both type obesity and the obesity trial, we also will provide an economic analysis with the help of the University of Ronto Vergata, in particular the Group of Public Health Economics, which will analyze the affordability of these interventions by the means of the microsimulation models for the healthcare systems. And also we analyze if such interventions, both in infancy and in adolescence, can improve the affordability of healthy diet for the families and can really change chronically the family habits. So Obelisk is a project that analyzes systematically the affordability alongside the effectiveness. And more very importantly, as I mentioned, is also the post-clinical component of the project, because Obelisk also features an expert panels committed to communicate with the stakeholders, so also with the policymakers, and also important projects of disseminations of and of guidelines building, so that the models we test in case of effectiveness and good acceptability can be largely scaled all over the Europe.
Wow, a really comprehensive study looking at so many of the different factors that might influence the development of obesity. It sounds fascinating. Thank you so much for your time today, Anita, and for sharing all your expertise on this topic. It has been really, really interesting. I've certainly enjoyed the conversation. If you are interested in health, obesity, and more specifically childhood obesity, keep an eye on the Obelisk website and our social media channels, as we'll be sharing useful information and research updates from the project about these topics. If you found this podcast interesting, please share it with your friends and colleagues. And if you have any questions regarding today's theme or any other topic regarding childhood obesity, we'd love to hear from you. Just hop onto our socials, leave us a comment there, or you can email obelisk@betatechnology.co.uk and we will try and solve them for you. Thanks again to Anita, and stay tuned everyone for our next episode.